Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you sweet pod people out there. I'm your host, Leo Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be the Gig. Thank you for tuning in. It's your little backstage pass to the world of live music. And each and every week, we try our bestest, try our hardest to bring you a really fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And what that means is us chatting to musicians, a festival founder, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anyone who is obsessed with performance in the way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fantastic interviews, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello!
Hey!
What's going on in Engineer Adam's world, apart from harmonizing?
Yeah, I've just got that beautiful voice I wanted to share with
Thank
the
you.
World. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so glad.
I'm here celebrating the release of a new iPod.
Oh.
I never thought I'd see the day, but we've got a new iPod out in the world. Well, not yet, but soon.
You mean like we've stepped into 2009?
Exactly. We've because stepped into a brighter past.
It's basically an iPhone without the phone, right?
Yes, but now all those people who are sick and tired of having to use up space on their phone for music and podcasts.
You got the iPod back, baby. And I was thinking of that the other day. That's exactly what I was thinking of. I have no space. I can't fit any more photos. I can't fit any more apps. I cannot fit any more podcasts or books. I need to get something else. And I was like, why don't they invent something? But really, I feel like if you plan on buying the new iPod.
Yes.
Touch.
Yes.
What is it called? iPod Touch.
The iPod Touch. Seventh gen.
I have a really good tip.
Yes.
Okay. Go to Amazon.com.
Yes.
This is not sponsored, by the way. This is not
it
hashtag ad. No. Go to Amazon.com. Search iPhone 7. It has Touch ID. It's got a much bigger screen. It's got cell data. And just click buy. Because this new iPod is basically an iPhone 7.
Just without connection to a...
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. Really. Huh. It's maybe iPhone 7's a little bit better, actually.
Maybe they should release another Zune.
Maybe they should just turn everybody into computers.
Do you remember the Zune? I love the Zune. It was a giant brick with a touch wheel
on it. I love my iPod. The old Classique. And then I had the Nano.
Oh, fancy.
I used to play solitaire on that boy, that bad boy. That was wonderful. I really remember those days. That's funny how the world does the loop, ooh, you, alley-oop-de-oop. What do you call it?
Alley-oop-de-loop-de-loop.
because we've now, just like fashions, are now going backwards in technology. Retro. And they are now realizing that we absolutely need something separate to our lives. So our lives are so busy in this platform that they've created on this phone that we now need to have something completely separate. I also would recommend a record player.
Well, yes. Ultra retro.
I would also recommend having a friend, just again, as I said earlier, become a computer. Yeah, we could do that too.
I like both of these ideas.
And just today, I walked past somebody playing music from his iPhone, just like a boombox.
Was he holding it on his shoulder?
Sure. Of course he was. This is I don't make the rules. This is your day. Of course he was. But I'm excited for the conversation to start up again in terms of premiumization, because everything is becoming premium and creating another iPod accessory, just like they did again, iPhone without the phone, is kind of genius to go backwards, but forwards, backward, forwards,
forward, backward, backward,
forward,
forward.
Back, forward. Yeah. So I don't mind it.
And once you get your new iPod Touch 7th generation, or your iPhone 7 that Lior's recommending, or your Zune, or even just on your phone right now, go ahead and leave us a note about how much you love our show on all the social medias. Woo-hoo. At TMBTGpod or at Lior Phillips, LIORPHILLIPS. Better yet, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll shout you out on the show. This week, we've got a shout out going to Ballerina Girl out in Australia.
Oh, cool.
Who had this wonderful note. Divine descriptions and engaging stories. Love listening to Lior's smooth tones and connecting with her on her journey. Thanks again for those wonderful words, Ballerina Girl. That's pretty awesome.
Thank you. That's a great superhero name, by the way.
I think we should kind of adopt that. I would watch that
Marvel
movie.
Marvel, you can have the rights to Ballerina Girl.
Black Swan, Black Panther crossover.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Ballerina Girl. That's really lovely. And this week is really exciting because we return you to our coverage from the incredible Moog Fest in North Carolina with not one, but two chats with insiders who changed the music world and helped bring some of your favorite artists in the world to light. Our first chat this week features the tremendous talent that is Daniel Miller, the founder of one of my favorite record labels, Mute Records. And it's the label that brought the world Depeche Mode, Erasure, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and so many others. Reach out to me directly if you want to know more.
Just a direct list of Lior's favorite Mute records.
Honestly, I will give you a list and some stories. In our conversation, I spoke with Daniel about seeing his first concerts, what they were, and buying his first Korg 700S and his exploration of the UK music scene in the late 70s and early 80s as a performer and a producer and a label head. And after that, what do we have?
We've got a second interview. That's right. This week, we've got two amazing conversations. The second this week is with the producer, composer, and all-around music zealot, Craig Leon. Craig's been seemingly at the intersection of every musical moment in the U.S. since helping to discover seminal punk and no-wave bands like the Ramones, Suicide, and Talking Heads, all bands that are extra special and important in this neck of the woods. You got to sit down with Craig and his partner, psych folk country musician Castle Webb, to talk about Craig's time in CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, his work with Pavarotti, Castle's first-hand experience with Buddy Holly, and Craig's new record, Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music, Volume 2, which is out now on Revenge International.
So let us not be delayed. This is me and Daniel and Craig and Castle. Enjoy!
I got into, where are we? Durham. I got here on Thursday evening, but I was in New York for a couple of days before that.
Okay. Yeah. Do you often not know where you are because you're so busy?
Well, I definitely often don't know where I am when I wake up in the morning. I thought, you know, so,
I mean, that happens, I suppose, when you get a little, you know, when you have a lot going on. Do you find that there's certain times in the year where things are a little bit more intense work-wise, or is there no cycle to what you
There's not really, I mean, not really. it's pretty, because I mean, we're all, from the label point of view, you know, we're always getting, you know, we work around 6 months up front from a finished record to release.
Okay.
So it's, you know, we're always working ahead. So it's always, yeah, it's always, you know, it goes in fits and starts, but it's generally busy all the time, either with making a record or selling a record or going to gigs or.
6 months doesn't seem too long. 6 months seems.
Well, that's from the delivery of the final.
Oh, right. Okay.
The final masters and the final artwork.
Yes.
Because you need a lot of time to set everything up and vinyl, you know, because we do everything on vinyl and vinyl pressing takes a long time. So you have to kind of.
Yeah,
build that in.
Make sure that.
But Mona would tell you that it's never really 6 months, and it's always a bit of a rush in the end. Yeah. But the theory
Mona's
is 6 months.
Mona's nodding in the corner. But so, do you find in terms of like trends over the last few years that things have started to shift a little in terms of the creation of a project versus, you know, maybe years and years ago, things maybe took. Either quicker because there was guaranteed radio play or, you know, just in terms of the business of that side.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the recording side of things has changed completely. I mean, everything's changed. The music has to be good. That's the constant. That's the only real constant. Everything else has changed. How you make the records, how you distribute the records, how you promote the records has changed completely in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, you know.
Mm.
And some of that's really good. And some of it is not so good, or not that it's not good. It's just like not so much fun, shall we say?
Yeah.
But
what are the challenges though? What doesn't make what?
Well, I think for instance, you know, especially with streaming, it's become very track based rather than album based. There's been a reaction to that with the kind of resurgence of vinyl. But the resurgence of vinyl is great, but it's not as like it's still small in relation to everything else, you know. Mm. And I think Spotify mainly, but the platforms are kind of very track orientated and single orientated. So for music that people want to be a bit more thoughtful about or put it together in a different way, it's not so easy. You know, people don't listen to albums that much, and I think that's frustrating for the musicians. You know, and for us because we. I wouldn't say that our music is album orientated. That sounds really old fashioned.
But it is. It's totally. Yeah. Style is completely front to back, I feel.
Yeah. Those things are not in our control particularly. You know, we have to adapt.
You have to be adaptable.
Yeah.
How hard is that to navigate in terms of making sure that you keep your style and you keep the essence of it, keep the consistency of the music good, and also make sure to cater to how ever changing because you know Spotify could go away tomorrow as well. I think people don't realize
of
that,
course,
that that library that you've created or it's not you but people that could go away. So how do you keep
I mean there was always radio. Okay, Spotify is kind of the new radio in a sense.
Totally.
And we you know we used to do depending on the artist and the you know the kind of the goal for the project we would do radio edits for instance like that and we do Spotify edits now. And we do even shorter Spotify edits for our presentations.
Yeah.
When we go in there, we do like...
Oh, my gosh.
You know, 2-minute versions of songs, you know, But, you know, and that's frustrating, can be frustrating. And I personally actually quite enjoy that process of editing because I like the idea of getting a message across in a short amount of time.
You do.
Well, I studied film and TV. And my first job when I left college was working in a company that did commercials.
Mm.
And I didn't really like the content, but the technique was really... I learned a lot from that, how to get a message across in a short amount
quickly.
Of time. And the kind of music I grew up with, all those songs were like 3 minutes, 2.5 minutes long, and they were operas, you know what I mean? They were epic, but they were still only two... And I think... You know, some of those things, you know, when there was a track that was like 5 minutes long, that like Good Vibrations or something, that was a real exception, you know. And I mean, it's not that I love long tracks as well that really evolve over a long period of time, but I think the idea of getting not a message isn't quite the right word, but the kind of a feeling
across
a story or a feeling, an atmosphere, you know, like, oh, we have to have a long intro because we need to build up the atmosphere.
Yeah.
That, you don't. You know, I mean, if it makes sense musically, yes, but not just, you know, you should, you know, let's try and build the atmosphere.
Yeah, and like in terms of sequence, I suppose, starting something, you know, like a minute long instrumental, intro makes sense, but not within the span of like the third song, 8 minutes long. Yeah,
exactly. You know.
But I quite like that you've brought that up. That is quite a talent to be able to tell your story very quickly.
Yeah.
And especially with societies like constant ADHD.
Yeah.
I feel like I have millions of tabs open in my phone, on my computer. There's just so much happening.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that obviously where you started, was your family in actors and everybody was in film? Is that how you started?
Well, my parents were actors, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you just naturally went into that because they were in the field?
Not really. I wouldn't say it was natural. I mean, they were... I don't know how natural it was. It's hard to say, isn't it? But it was something I was interested in. I was always I was always more interested in music, actually, than that. But I wasn't very good at playing music, so... That was my second choice, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the click for you when you decided to leave the film side of things? Because I feel like film and music, those two are tangentially connected, right?
Yeah.
Because you need a visual brain for both.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how your brain is very visual, considering what you've done. When did you decide to shift into the music?
Well,
side.
I worked in film for a few years after I left college. Then I just got really sick of it, and I just travelled for a while, and I ended up DJing in the mountains in Switzerland. And
was that your first ever performance that you ever did, like your first concert that you?
No, it wasn't, because when I was at school, we did school gigs and stuff like that.
Okay, yes, yeah.
But
this is your first DJ.
My first DJ, and that was great because I wanted to get out of I grew up in London and I just wanted to get out of the city for a while and get into some fresh air and nice landscape and things. So I ended up there, and while I was there, obviously I was buying records and stuff like that as a DJ, and it was very pop oriented. It was like a holiday resort, so it was like chart stuff, which is okay. You know, I didn't like everything I played, but I liked the experience of the lights going down.
I told you what happened. I don't know why.
So I like the experience of making people enjoy themselves to music. You know?
Yeah. So even if it's not servicing your...
I mean, most of it wasn't really my taste.
Mm.
But that didn't really matter because it was functional and I enjoyed that side of it.
Mm.
And then towards the end of my time there, the first rumblings of punk started. And that really kind of interested me. You know, there were no records at that time.
Mm.
This was before the Ramones' first album and stuff, before the Sex Pistols.
Yes.
But, you know, I used to read about what was going on in CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, and I thought, this sounds really interesting. And I got back to London at the end of the season. I got back to London and, you know, the first punk gigs were starting to happen. And it was just a very exciting time.
Mm.
I thought this is a moment that it's kind of opened a door for somebody like me who... had musical stuff in my head, but wasn't able to really translate that into actual music. I thought this was a moment that I could kind of somehow engage in. And I was had been into electronic music for a long time. So at that point, I, you know, went back to work to earn some money to buy a cheap synth and a tape recorder, and that was it, really.
What was your first cheap synth?
Yeah, Korg 700S.
Oh, wow.
It's
an amazing one. Yeah,
it's great. And my first recordings that I released were just done with that and nothing else, on a 4-track. So all the sounds came from a 700S. I think it's a great synth.
How did you figure out how to play it? Was it just like trial by error and making a lot of mistakes as you went along?
Yeah, I mean it's quite a. I mean I didn't really. Yeah, basically. But I mean it's not a complicated synthesizer. You know, you turn it on and there are sounds there. You know, it's not modular. You know, some of the switches are very basic and, you know, it's quite basic. But then I learned how to get the things that I wanted out of it, you know.
So before, I really like what you said about how punk kind of opened that up for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel, like, how did you connect to that spirit? Because punk now is, of course, incredibly different to punk then.
But it wasn't,
how did you connect?
It was about the energy, you know, it was part, there was the different kinds of punk. Do you know what I mean? There's, you know, you had the Sex Pistols or the Ramones, who were like a proper band. And then you had the early things like early Banshees and things like that, which were people who just couldn't play, but just got up on stage and did it. And I think
it was like the punk attitude.
Yeah, it was more the ethic. I mean, I enjoy, you know, I loved the Ramones' first album and all those early punk records, the Damned and the Pistols. But in the end, it was still rock music. They were all pretty good rock musicians, you know, and that. But I gravitated more to the things where people couldn't really play, but were getting, in a conventional way, but were getting really interesting energy. It was about the energy of it more than anything, the attitude and the energy rather than the music. I kind of, in my head, that kind of connected to electronic music, the possibilities of electronic music, because with electronic music, you don't have to be able to play an instrument to play. I mean, you know, I wasn't a keyboard player. I never was a keyboard player. It was just like, boo, boo, you know. And, and I, those things... things connected in my head, and that's why I ended up getting the synth and the tape recorder. And it was a time when those things became much more accessible to people, you know, because up to that point synthesizers were very, very expensive. And
yeah, of course, because the demand
Well, they were, you know, they were made in small quantities, hand built, and, you know, extremely high quality. But then the Japanese, you know, Roland and Korg were making things that were like mass-produced and cheaper, and were not. I mean, you look at the Korg 7, you can see that it's meant to be like an accompaniment instrument on top of a Hammond organ. It's got little things from music stand on the top and stuff like that. I don't think it was ever meant to be making the kind of sounds that.
Or they never thought that would be.
Yeah,
possibly the demand as well for that. They never thought that would be popular.
I think it was like real, you know, things like, well, you can get a nice flute sound, or you can get a nice, you know, violin sound or something like that. You know,
It was more for convenience than just.
But I have to say, the Korg 700S had some pretty weird shit on it. It had
like what?
It had like three different ring modulators on it. It had some things on it that no other synth has ever really matched. I still have it. I love it, and it's got really interesting features on it, even though it's a really cheap kind of simple instrument. There's tons of possibilities in there. You know?
When you decided then after that to pursue your own music and support bands and you know, do your own thing, was there a show that you played that it just clicked for you, where, you know, necessarily for like a vocalist, where they found their voice? Was there a place or a time, other than the gig in Switzerland, that you really found that place?
And from a live point of view, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what happened was that there were quite a few of those singles came out around 1978, and I met Robert Rentel, who'd also put out his own single, at a Throbbing Gristle gig.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's a classic kind of... Because we were just all hanging out after the gig, and we were talking to... You know, I'd never met Throbbing Gristle before, but it was like a really nice little kind of... Everybody was very friendly and supportive. And I met Robert, and then, you know, we got together a couple of times just to like, talk about stuff. And then there was a company called Final Solution who did... They were concert promoters.
Okay.
And they were doing a lot of the kind of alternative concert promoters, you know, concerts in that time. They did, you know, all the early Joy Division things. And so, you know, they were really great promoters. And they wanted to put on a gig in a small place called The Crypt in West London. And they wanted to kind of feature all those people who had made those electronic records. So they had Cabaret Voltaire, they had Throbbing Gristle.
Wow.
And they asked me and Robert separately if we would perform, and I couldn't really figure out how we would do it, and he couldn't figure out how he would do it. So we decided let's do it together, and that was the first gig we did. And then that was going to be a one off, and then we got invited to play in Paris. There was a great club called the Gibus Club, and they were renowned for, they did a lot of the early punk stuff there, and you would do like a 3-night residency there. And then through my connect, you know, I knew the people at the Rough Trade, because they were distributing my record, selling my record. They put together a tour with Stiff Little Fingers, who were on Rough Trade at the time, and Essential Logic, who were also on Rough Trade. Allura Logic was in originally with X-Ray Specs.
Wow, yeah.
And they asked us if we want to do this tour, and we said, yeah, why not? You know, like, you know, this is probably a one-off.
Might as well.
Might as well do it, you know. So, and it turned out to be a long tour. It was like a 35-date tour.
Oh,
it kept expanding because Stiff Little Fingers had just released their album, and it was like the first big independent commercial success. And it was a chart album, and so it was kind of supposed to be a very kind of egalitarian thing, but they were really the stars. Mm. They were the real headliners. It was supposed to be much more kind of flat, but they were much more well known. But and people really hated what we were doing, pretty much. You know,
really?
Oh yeah.
Well, what, like, vocally hated it?
Well, more than vocally, they threw stuff. I mean, it was, you know, punk time. But we'd come off stage and we were, you know, there was broken glass on the stage.
Oh,
people
gosh.
Were spitting at us and stuff like
what?
That.
What?
It had just happened before with Suicide, who supported The Clash. It was the same thing for them, probably on a bigger level because The Clash were much bigger. But there was always like one or two or three people after the shows who came back and said, oh man, that changed my life. What's the synthesizer? You know, because we used a backing tape with some rhythm stuff on it. And I had my Korg 700S and Robert had a Wasp synth.
Oh.
And Chris Carter from Throbbing Gristle had built him a Gristleizer to go with his...
Chris is amazing, yeah.
And, you know, and it was alien to most... Nobody really seen... Most people really hadn't seen stuff like that, especially that generation. They were all, you know, they were kids, really. And so for every 1,000 people who hated us, it was like one or two who
But that matters,
and that
right?
really matters, and it meant a lot to us, you know. Mm. And so we didn't really care, you know, and we never left the stage. Mm. We were never bottled off, so...
Yeah.
We used to look at each other and go, yeah, no, let's keep going.
Is it time to go? Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
But so how did you find the confidence then in terms of knowing that, finding that you could really listen to those three people? Because it's very hard to drown that out. And especially you were learning in the process of the audience learning as well. You were both learning. You
oh,
were
totally.
Learning
about we hadn't, didn't have a clue what we were doing.
And they were...
and they didn't have a clue what they were seeing, you know, so...
I'm sure they were like, what is this?
Yeah.
So how did you find the confidence to then carry on and then pursue, you know, a life in that?
I had no plan to do that. When I released the first single, I just thought it was going to be a one-off thing and I'd just get on with my life, whatever that was going to be. But it did quite well. I mean, I was shocked how, you know, people liked it. I didn't think people would like it.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I was.
I think that's why.
I was very proud. I was very proud. It actually sounded like what I wanted it to sound like, which was, the thing about working with a synthesizer. I could actually I could have an idea in my head and I got it onto tape, which I was never able to do before. Mm. And, you know, so I didn't really know what to do. So after I put the first single out, then we did some of these live shows and I was kind of pottering around and getting records pressed and stuff like that. And I got demos, but I didn't really know what to do with them because I had no real intention to be a label. I didn't, you know, didn't want to be a record label. And then there's a guy who I knew, a guy called Edwin Pouncey, who at the time was a cartoonist. He was the punk cartoonist for Sounds.
Okay.
And I kind of knew him just from hanging out. And he told me about this guy who was sharing his flat with him, a guy called Frank Tovey, whose artist name was Fad Gadget. And I thought that sounded interesting. And I heard some of the demos and I met Frank. And I thought, this is something I can really relate to this on lots of different levels. And so I said, let's put out a single. And that's really when the label started as a functioning label.
Wow.
Well, it was just me, but it was... No office or anything like that. But it was, you know.
So where were you working out of
I was working out of home. I did a bit of part-time work for Rough Trade at the time because that was growing so
and
fast.
And you had that relationship with
them. Yeah, and so they had a little office and I would hang out there and, you know, but yeah, no, I just, you know.
So when you started signing bands and you almost assumed that position and it was natural, clearly.
Yeah.
When you started signing bands, how did you know what you were looking for? Or did you find it when you heard it?
Well, first of all, I wasn't signing bands.
Yeah.
because there were no contracts.
Yeah. Okay.
So I wasn't well, technically signing bands. We were just deciding to work together and split the profits 50-50.
Wow. Okay.
You know, I would finance it in the kind of minimal way that you know, and yeah, that was it really. So I don't know. I just had a feeling. I suppose I had an idea. I mean, I was always very, even when I was a kid, when I started getting into music in the 60s, I was very particular about what I liked, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was never a record collector and never have been a record collector.
Are you still not?
No. I'm not a record collector because I don't like very much music. There's not very
Wait.
Much music that I... That, well, there's not much... Okay, there's not, you know...
Can you imagine this is like for a written thing? Daniel Miller does not like music. No, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just really, really particular. Yeah, and I suppose when I look back, when I was a kid, that's quite a good thing if you're going to run a record label. I mean, I didn't think about it at the time, but if you just say, what kind of music do you like? Oh, I like all kinds of music. I mean, that's possible. I'm not saying that's not possible, but it's not possible for me. I'm really particular. I don't like having music around me that I don't like in my home or whatever. There's no point. It's just sitting there gathering dust. And so, you know, of course, I mean, music is the most, you know, for me, is the most powerful, emotional medium, but in order for it to be powerful and emotional, it has to be very special, you know. It can't just be any old thing, you know.
So was there a band that, you know, obviously like New Order and Depeche Mode had made waves, but was there a band that you feel particularly that didn't get enough attention at the time that you really...
Nearly everybody I worked with didn't get enough attention.
Like who?
Well, you start with Fad Gadget. I mean...
Yeah.
He got quite a lot of attention, but didn't get, you know...
Nearly as much.
You know, I mean, Depeche... for lots of reasons, mostly the music, but also the timing of when they started was, like, perfect timing.
And
people were looking for... You know, when you come to the end of something in music, a phase, a trend in music, and people are looking for something, fresh, that's a great time to do something fresh, because then, even if it's not great, they were great, but even if it's not great, you'll get some attention because it's something different, you know. I remember it was the same in going forward, like, 25 years. We started working with the Prodigy in America, and you could not get arrested. You know, it was the grunge time, so they had two major things against them. They were British and they were electronic.
Yeah.
and just nobody was interested. And then people got bored with grunge, and all of a sudden Prodigy played at a festival, and there's one radio station in America that played Prodigy, called a station called The End in Seattle, and they invited them to play at a grunge festival, basically. They were the only non-grunge band playing.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, people really related to it, you know. And MTV were there, and they said, "Oh God, there's something new. We're sick of all these grunge bands." And anyway.
Also, visually, I mean, what they looked like in
they were a great band. It's not that's not the thing, and they were very different. It's just that
timing.
At a certain point, if you're different, you don't fit in, and then the next minute, if you're different, you're exactly what people are looking for. It's a strange phenomenon in music. And probably in lots of other things as well, but you know, there are a lot of. There's a lot of bands on mute. I mean, especially, you know, I always cite Renegade Soundwave as one of the bands, and it was partly their fault, I have to say.
Because why? What did they do?
Well, they hated each other so much, and they were so paranoid of each other, and they kind of imploded. And so they never. But musically, they made some amazing records that of course, there were a lot of people who liked it, but it never got the kind of accolade that it deserved. I mean, there are lots of them. I could name 80% of the Mute roster, I would say, that didn't get the attention they deserved.
That it deserved. Yeah. But do you find, like...
Not that you deserve it. It's not about deserve.
Yes.
It's more about, you know, that, you know, it's just like...
That the output is weighing up with getting that attention.
You know, another kind of period which was really... bad for us was the Britpop era, because you know, it was completely counterintuitive to what we were doing. You know, it was very backwards looking, it was very traditional, it was very you know.
Yeah, even just the format of how those songs
and,
were written.
And, you know, people just, we just couldn't get anywhere with any of our music, you know.
But that's all pretty much over now.
Yeah, but there's always something. But, you know, I'm not, listen, it sounds like I'm complaining. I'm not.
I mean, I don't think it does at all. I feel like there is so much knowledge that you carry with what you've done, but in a very, you come from a very different place because you've lived through it. Yeah. It's very different if you are sitting here as this exec who's taken this role over the last year. You've actually lived through it.
Yeah.
But do you feel like there was one concert that you saw, one live performance, a band or something that really shifted the way that you saw live music, and you, and you, maybe not from your own performance and people throwing stuff at you, but
You mean something that I was involved with, or something? I mean, there were concerts. I mean, all the concerts, well, not all, but a lot of the, you know, I used to go to, obviously, when I was a teenager, I went to gigs.
Like, what was your first one? What was the first proper gig
I went to when I was about 14, I guess?
Yeah,
was the Beach Boys.
What? Oh my gosh,
and I was. I was a huge Beach Boys fan.
Wow.
And it was still the time when they were wearing their stripy shirts. And Brian
Somebody
Wilson
told them that was okay. Yeah.
And Brian Wilson was not really in the band at that, or the live band at that time, but he was kind of on stage fiddling with things. It was kind of around the Good Vibrations tour.
Where was that? In London as
Hammersmith,
well.
It was used to call the Hammersmith Odeon. Yeah. But now it's called something else. They keep changing the name, but it's still there as a great venue. Yeah. Well, a great venue. It's still an important venue.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that was, you know, and other, you know, well, I mean, you know, I saw, it's hard to say, but I mean, I remember seeing Faust on stage around 73, around that time. It was much later on. And they were just had, like, they were on stage, and before they came on, the stage was filled with things like TVs and pinball machines and stuff like that. And they were just miking everything up and playing along, and they were just tuning into the TV and stuff like that. And then the guy, right in the front of the stage, there was a big concrete block. And I didn't really know what the concrete block was for. And then at the end, they all walked off, and this one of their entourage walked on, like, with a long black leather coat and a pneumatic drill.
Oh, my God.
And just started, drilling the concrete. And this was, like, this was years before Neubauten or...
That's crazy.
Yeah, and I remember that as being a very... That was, like, mind-blowing, yeah.
And you said that was in 73?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Around there?
Yeah, around 72, 73, and then... You know, seeing Can live for the first time, and, you know, just seeing all those bands, or Tangerine Dream, you know, it was just the first kind of real all electronic thing I ever saw, with their banks of, you know, Moog modular. That was incredible as well. You know, I mean, all those things.
It's a world. They create a world. Yeah.
And also, but also, not just, you know, I mean, I was a huge Fleetwood Mac fan. This was a Peter Green version of Fleetwood Mac when they were blues, much more blues orientated, and those gigs were amazing. And I saw a lot of the old blues guys, you know, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker and B.B. King.
Also, when you were younger, do you find, like, that you saw a lot of those bands?
Yeah, it was when I was younger, yeah. Because, like, because all those British bands, like, well, especially Fleetwood Mac, who were pretty big at the time, they always invited the American, the originals, to come over and play with them, you know. So it was great to, that was great. I got... You know, and there was a thing called the Rock Proms, at the Albert Hall, in this, I guess, late, you know, 68, 67, around then, and they promoted a lot of the black, you know, well, the original, you know, blues guys, and that was, I loved, and I was really, I still am really into that kind of music.
So when you were younger, was that kind of music playing in your house? You know, bluesy, more.
Well, it was playing in my bedroom.
Yeah. Okay. Not your house. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, my parents were more into classical music and things like that. I mean, they didn't have a problem with me listening to it. It wasn't like shut that noise down or anything. I never got told not to play music, but that music. I was like, I mean, I'm an only child, so I didn't have an older brother or sister
to pass down.
But yeah, I always used to hang out with slightly. Oh, I mean, I didn't hang out with them, but the guys at school were only 2 or 3 years old. Everybody was totally into music. So, and they, for some reason, realized that I was into music, so they would play me stuff. And, you know, it was just that.
Yeah. And lastly, because we probably have to wrap up soon, is there a band that you have at the moment that you are really excited by? Somebody who you particularly, that you want to get out there as quickly as possible, and you just find that the landscape is not as it used to be, or just someone that's not getting the attention?
First of all, I wouldn't put records out if I wasn't excited about them. So I'm excited
about
it.
Told you it was a hard question, difficult
well, it's
to
easy.
Answer.
That's an easy question to answer. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't... Yeah. Why would I? You know, we don't put out that many records.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't put anything out that I wasn't excited about. And, you know, some things are more difficult than others to get across. You know, I mean, our latest signings are Daniel Bloomberg. I don't know if you've heard his music. He combines kind of classic songwriting with free jazz in a way, or improvised music. And that's been, even though we got some good, you know, press and stuff like that, that's been more difficult than I thought. We just released our first album with Karine, and that's, you know, that's starting off quite well. So, you know, but I'm excited about everything I put out. I mean, life's too short to put out records that you're not excited about.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Do you have like that Mute? Do you feel like Mute has a style? A particular style? Like, if you have all the roster in front of you, do you feel like it all has the same identity?
I think the identity is created in my, I would like to think that, I mean, musically, obviously, we're quite diverse. You know, you've got Daniel Bloomberg on one side, or you've got Karine, they're very different, really, music kind of genre. But I would like to think that what defines it is the kind of the quality of it, you know? And the originality of it. So in my head, it all fits together. To some people, it's like, how can you have the Amanda Galas and Erasure? How does that work? And well, funnily enough, the Amanda and Erasure collaborating on stuff.
Yeah, so exactly. Even, you know, so it works.
Yeah, so I mean, but it all means something to me. It all connects in my head. And the team that we've got, a great team of people at Mute over here in New York and in London. And, you know, while they don't necessarily get all of it when they start, they understand what it is. You know, they don't have to like everything they do, but they understand why it's there. They understand the reason
for it. There's a place for it,
and, you know, so it's, yeah.
Do you feel like there is an artist that you haven't seen live that you have wanted to see? Because it sounds like you've seen pretty much all of your bucket list people. But is there or maybe someone you wanted to meet and really chat to and pick their brain? Is there anyone?
Well, it's a tricky one because the people, I'm a real fan of the things that I like.
Yeah.
And I get very nervous when I meet those people.
Yeah, naturally.
You know, when we started first, we've been releasing the Can catalogue for 25 years now, and they were like, you know,
huge.
They still are, like, you know, musical total inspiration. So that took a while to, and still I'm still a bit of a, even after 25 years it's still like, but I do like, yeah, picking their brains. I mean, I vaguely knew the guys from Kraftwerk. I'd met them a few times, but I got to know Florian Schneider recently a bit better, and went to his studio in Düsseldorf, and I was I kind of lost the shyness. I just had to ask, well, what the fuck is that? Yeah. You know, because there's stuff in there.
What is that thing protruding from the wall?
Yeah, you know, and you know, so
it's, I mean, good when, to
when,
get
when, when, when I when I when I when I hear music that I really love, of course I'm interested, even if it's not somebody who's famous or is legendary. But yeah, I you know, when I'm, if we're talking to an artist and we want to sign, for instance, or we want to work with, of course, then I become really interested in how they make it and what the process is, and because that informs me a bit about where it could go. And I think that's the important thing. It's not like where they are
story.
Now. It's more about, it's, you know, we like to work really long term with artists.
That's a good point.
So it's very important to know where it's going in their heads, you know. And it's not just about, well, this is a great three tracks you've sent us. It's like, okay, that's, but where is it going, and how do you make it, and what do you need, and to help you realize your vision? You know?
Yeah, but you have contracts now. You're not 50-50.
No, we do 50-50.
Do you still do that?
And sometimes, yeah,
okay.
When it's appropriate. We do 50-50, but we still have contracts, but we have contracts now.
Yeah.
And that's not because of us so much. I mean, when we started in the first, I don't know, 6-7 years of Mute, I never spoke to a lawyer.
Wow.
Either I didn't have a lawyer, and the bands didn't have lawyers.
Do you think we almost at your success?
And none of them had managers either.
Yeah.
And it was. Wow. And most of those artists that came out of that period. Well, those for instance, Depeche and then later Erasure or Yaz and Erasure and the Bad Seeds and we had over 30 years working relationships with those people and
it's like I'm shaking my head because thinking of that doing that now
I know
it's impossible.
It's not impossible.
No, but I'm saying starting out like that now in this day and age much.
Yeah, I mean it's. I think, rightly or wrongly, artists think of labels as an unsafe space, shall we say?
Yeah, because they've been treated badly in the past.
Yeah, and I hate the term safe space, but in this case, it's kind of appropriate.
It's valid, absolutely.
And so they want protection. From managers and lawyers, I don't want to slag off lawyers or managers, and there are good lawyers and there are destructive lawyers, and there are good managers and there are destructive managers.
Yeah, there's always a place for them. Yeah,
when you have a good manager on board, it's amazing to have that extra pairs of hands on the team. When you have somebody who's totally trying to justify themselves to the artist, it's a nightmare.
Not going
to
work.
It doesn't work, And some managers are very protective of their artists, and I like to have but not just me, our team, we want to talk to the artist about the artwork. We don't want to talk to the manager about the artwork. You know what I mean? Or the mix or something.
Well, you go
like
to the source.
Yeah.
And, that's the right way to
It's really important for us
art.
To have that kind of relationship with the artist. Mm. So in those early years, it was, none of us knew what we were doing. It was an amazing time because it's, still that kind of punk ethic, even if it wasn't punk music. And I suppose you could almost say it was a hippie ethic as well. I mean, most punks were people who were the kind of around, who were there. The punk were kind of really were kind of hippies. Or situationists,
exactly.
And so it all comes from the same place. I mean, I wasn't really a hippie, but I didn't live in a commune and stuff like that.
But having that freedom of thought.
Yeah, it was just very natural at that time. You weren't, it was kind of a natural thing of the generation that I came out of,
I love that. That's such a wonderful point. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
We're going to wrap up. I probably could chat to you forever. Got so many questions. But thank you for your time.
No,
for
thank
being
you.
Here and enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thanks very much.
And I loved your chat yesterday with Martin.
Oh, thank you.
You were so great.
Oh, it was, thank you. I enjoyed it.
You could see that you enjoyed it and you were enjoying it. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much. Cheers.
To LA and then back to New York and then a lot to London because of the record company that I worked for.
Yeah.
And a lot of the original, what they called the New York underground stuff or anything was the roots of the British punk thing. Mm-hmm. And most of the bands I worked with were far more successful in Britain than they were in America, at least in the beginning. Mm. And
do you have an example of that you find? Because obviously I can give you an example of which one was more famous, but who were you referring to? That was more famous in Britain than in America.
Oh, virtually most of them. Blondie certainly. Blondie was one of the biggest bands in England, and they own. Many years later, did they start getting hits in the UK? And very few of them compared to like 20 in England, and everywhere else outside of the US. And the Ramones were far more influential and far more known in England than they were in the States. Suicide was equally hated everywhere, except at my house.
My house.
people used to throw bottles at them. They used to open for they would open for the Clash, and people like that. And those punks were, they were like really offended by suicide, and they would throw bottles and.
And were you at those shows?
I was at a couple of them, but mostly. I was in New York. I didn't travel with them, luckily, because they were pretty wild shows. But I saw a couple. I didn't see the famous one in Brussels that was recorded. But I saw them in England, and that happened.
So yeah. So then you moved. Okay, so you were in New York, LA.
But this is way before that.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing that before we met.
Okay.
And then I was I was living in LA actually at the time, and I was producing.
There was a time span. We both had different lives at different times.
Yeah, and
converged.
So we both did music at different sides of the world. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
So I was doing a country record.
Okay.
Because I went, I got a chance to do some country records. Warner's, I have a pretty eclectic background to begin with.
Oh, yes.
And
I like it. Yeah, sure.
And in any case, I was asked to do a couple of country records, and I did it, you know, because I grew up on that and everything else. And one of them was to be recorded in Texas. And I went down there and I was recording this guy making his album. And it was the kind of thing, like it was an assembly line. The guy who owned the studio, who was the manager of the artist and was probably pocketing most of the budget and all of this kind of stuff, would be herding musicians. And he'd say, it was odd because usually I have a relationship with most of this, even session players that I would use, even orchestral session players. I pick who I want in the orchestra.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was like, no, you just tell me what instruments you want. I said, well, I need a violin, a fiddle. Okay. And some guy would show up and play the fiddle. And so I said, well, we need background singers, you know? And so these two women were going to go show up and sing background on the record. And I didn't know who they were. And on this particular record was a lady named Bonnie Bramlett, who was a really good singer in Texas, and Castle, who was very much a part of all of the background vocals on a lot of those records in Texas.
Amazing.
And that's where we met, actually. I was it's a real country western story. I was playing pool out in the out in the kind of the recreation area of the studio. And in Texas, if somebody's recording, it's kind of like an excuse for a party. And everybody was in town would be hanging. So there were about like 80 people in this room. No? Okay, 60. Maybe. 60? No, 24. Okay. Well, there was a whole...
It's okay.
No, it felt like 80.
Well, there were a whole bunch of people there, including bands that were in town. A couple of guys from The Clash were actually there, and various different guys, different singers from Austin and everything.
Wow.
And it would be weird. You'd go in and record the record, and the guy would be out there, and the band would be playing. And there'd be like 12 people lined up on the wall going, sounds pretty good to me, Bubba, you know? And... And so in any case, I was playing pool, and Castle ended up playing pool with me. And I said, well, what are you here to do? Because I had no idea who was doing what. And she said, well, I'm waiting for some idiot producer to show up.
I'm just waiting, you know, for this.
Some
guy is going to come in and be producing.
She said it with disdain. I'm waiting for this guy. You know, and
waiting for, come on, the session's late.
Yeah.
Everything's late.
You're
I'm going to be
patient.
Standing here for 5 hours. Bonnie, when are we going to get over with? You know, when do we get paid?
It's always in tech. When do you get paid? Everywhere in the world.
And then I looked up, and what did you have to say?
Well, I said, I'm the guy you're waiting for, and I'll kick out whoever's supposed to come in next, and you guys do it. So they went in and did the session, and from there,
throughout the years,
we met, and and she helped me put together another record down there that they had me trying the same label.
Okay.
Had another fellow down there named Doug Somm, who had a band called the Sir Douglas Quintet, and he owed them an album, and I was a big fan. He said, and the guy who ran the label said, well, when you're down there doing this Guy Clark thing, can you, if you find Doug Somm, He owes us a record, and you can produce the record, you know.
Wow.
Contractually, he has to do it. And I know he lives down there somewhere, you know, but we can't find him.
Yeah.
You know, the message to get in touch with him was to leave a message at a health food store. Oh. He'd call you back. So it turns out Castle knew him. Here, you tell the rest of the story.
Well, I knew him immensely because he's from San Antonio, and he and Augie and the band in that part of the world at that time were just amazing musicians, just a unique sound for that part of the world.
Mm.
So Craig said, "Oh, I'm looking for Dougie." I call him Dougie.
Yeah,
and little Dougie Rotten. Yes, and
he gave his name when he discovered punk.
Yeah. So, but you know, all of a sudden, I got hold of Doug. They were all playing baseball, so I went out and said, "Hey, come on. You want to go do something interesting? Come on, Doug. There's somebody that really wants to see you. Come on." Doug, he looked at me and he said, "Well, okay." And so they jumped in the car in their baseball outfits and we went down to the studio.
Wow.
And I was there and I asked them if they wanted to make a record. And they were all in baseball uniforms. The whole band was still intact and they were part of a softball team.
Wow.
And I said, "You know, you owe your label a record, and I'm doing this record on a friend of yours, and you know, I can do the record."
Yeah.
You know, and if you'd like, we can talk about it and see if I can get your sound and all of this stuff. I said, "Nah, it's okay. Mm. I'll call somebody." And he called an old other producer of his, Jerry Wexler, and he said, "If Jerry says you're okay, we don't have to talk or anything. We'll just make the record." And Jerry said I was okay.
Wow.
And then we did the record.
And you did.
Yeah, and then we started working together because of that record.
Okay.
And then things happened, and we just stayed together.
For the last 30 years.
30 years. It's more than 30 years.
It's
30-something.
30-something.
Yeah, from whenever 1979 was. Yeah.
You have to keep track. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter much.
Yeah. Awesome. You know who were the most hardcore guys ever?
Who?
Were the Texas football players that were the fans of the country guys. I was doing a country record in San Francisco, and a fan of the guy who was the artist was Rodney Crowell.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is like, drove up and created total havoc in our studio because he wanted to be at the session. And it was this big old guy who played football.
You credited with discovering those iconic bands in history.
Not the Texas Cowboys.
No, but you credited with those massive bands that also had fans, those loyal, crazy fans.
They
you said the Ramones.
Well, the Ramones had... zero fans when I first saw them, you know, as did any.
Do you remember the first time you saw them?
When I first saw the Ramones?
Mm.
I sought them out because they had handed around flyers.
Yeah.
And they'd been having a press campaign of sorts and on the Lower East Side in New York. And they had contacted the fellow who was going to become their manager, and it took him a long time to decide whether he wanted to be their manager or not, because they're pretty difficult guys. And in any case, there's a fellow named Danny Fields, and he had been a longtime A&R guy and journalist and part of the Andy Warhol crowd and all of that. And he was very, very much a scenester in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he was spreading the word about the Ramones and a couple of other journalists who hadn't really ever even seen them.
Mm.
There was no demo tapes or anything like that. It was just something they were saying, "This is really great. This is rock and roll." So I was seeing...
That's so rock and roll.
I was seeing little things in newspapers and showing them to my bosses at Sire, at the company. There were two guys that owned the company then. It wasn't just Seymour Stein.
Yeah.
And Richie Goddard, who was the guy who brought me up, who's a great producer in his own right, was one of the owners of that company.
Yeah.
And... I said, "Well,
you're
I got a
chance." Assistant.
I was Richie's assistant in the very, very beginning up there.
Sure.
Yeah, and there was nobody on staff at Sire. It was him, a secretary, and Seymour. And the first thing they did was hire me, and then they hired a promotion person and an art director, and they got money because they had a hit. They'd struggled for years. Sire had a whole history before the Ramones of doing really great music that nobody bought. And we're talking maybe they were around from like 67 or something like that. And they'd had a whole catalog of records before the Ramones. But they had a hit of a band from Holland that yodeled.
Really?
Yeah, it was called, the song was a novelty record called Hocus Pocus by Focus.
Oh.
And to me,
and that's how they made their money.
Well, it was a real big hit in America. And it was nothing. The band was actually a real prog rock, very good jazzy kind of players for that kind of music. But I wasn't a fan of that at that time. But Hocus Pocus was really funny. It was the guy singing like that and a flute playing. It was just ridiculous. But it went like top five or something in America. I don't know the exact number. And
so then you
they had this influx of money, so they said, we're going to expand.
We're going to have all these people, okay.
And so, so Richie brought me into the label, and because he needed help with a band that he was producing, a Climax Blues band.
Okay.
And the operative word was blues, which they had forgotten on this album that they had made. And he said, we got to do this over again, and it's got to get funkier and grittier and more like the blues. And he charged me with the job of putting them into my little studio in Florida.
Okay.
So he could have a holiday in Florida, and I would actually rehearse them and imbue them with blues from my old 78 collection and all of this. So
so you served more than one purpose.
So I did that, and then we recorded a bunch of stuff in my studio. He brought it up to New York. And then they went, you know, the feel on that was pretty good. So he asked me to come up to New York and continue working on the record. And then as things progressed, I decided I wanted to get a job and live in New York. And I was looking around at a couple of other labels. And that's a whole other funny story, how I almost ended up at another label except for Suicide.
Oh, wow.
Getting in the band Suicide, in there. But, but in any case,
I was fired, and people will know what you're talking
about. Yeah, I was fired before I was hired at another label. I applied for a job, and they asked me who I'd sign. They sent me out to see some glam rock band.
Yeah.
And I didn't like them, but Suicide was the opening act. And
you said you'd sign them.
And I said, I'd sign them. You need to sign this band. And they said, well, don't call us, we'll call you. So I immediately said, well, other label I know here is Sire, so I better get a job there.
Yeah.
So Richie wanted me to work with him. So
so then you said to Richie, I've seen the Ramones, or I've heard about them.
Yeah.
I got a flyer.
Well, it wasn't even that.
Yeah.
It was that I went down and saw them myself. I got in touch. I went, gosh, this is going really back into history. I'll get it chronologically. I'm out of order already.
Yes.
I was looking. I was in Richie and Seymour, because they'd had this influx of money and wanted to expand their label, got an idea. They used to take bands from Europe that American labels wouldn't release from their sister companies in Europe. Like EMI would put out a band, but Capitol, which was the EMI label in America,
wouldn't
release it.
Yeah.
They'd grab it for like a dollar and put it out and see what would happen. But it was all based on it being good music. It wasn't just anything. It would, you know, they had impeccable taste, especially in their junior A&R guys. But in any case, they said, well, why don't you go scouting around looking for some New York bands? Because, you know, and I talked to them. I said, yeah, we could do the same thing. We could take like, somebody like Lamont Young and sell him back to Europe, you know, because I was always into electronic music and avant-garde stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd go down messing around at the Kitchen and all of these other places and lofts in Soho and loft parties and go, you know, see Tony Conrad and all these people. And I'd go, and they would always go, you know, don't do that. And can we sign Annette Peacock? No, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But gradually, I'd heard that there was this whole scene of really cool people that were down there, and I went down to find Patti Smith and she had already had a long-term relationship with the label that she was signed with, and no, but then she wouldn't have signed with Sire at that point. Sire was like a very, very small label that nobody had ever heard of. It wasn't. It became famous later, but it wasn't famous yet because it didn't have anything anybody knew about. And you go to, the Ramones didn't want to be on Sire Records initially. You know, they said, well, maybe if we don't get anything else, you know. But and I said, look, I'll help you get a deal anywhere. You've got to get your music out there. But to Tommy, when I first met him, but in any case, I went down to CBGB's and talked to the guy who ran it, Hilly, and I said, what about Patti Smith? Is she playing here? And he introduced me to Terry Ork and Richard Lloyd and Tom Verlaine and all the people down there from television that were actually doing the booking of the bands.
Yeah.
And they said, here, there's plenty of bands here. He was really helpful. And he said, don't mess around with Patti, that, you know, she's kind of already spoken for and all that. But you should check out this band, the Ramones. And I said, yeah, I've seen some flyers from people like Lisa Robinson.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, and all of that. Nobody's heard anything that they did, but everybody says they're the saviors of rock and roll. So it was arranged that I would go to their loft. It wasn't their loft. It was Arturo's loft, Arturo Vega, who was their art director. And they had just finished making a video. And it was a video of, I think they didn't do it at Performance Studios. I think they did it in the loft.
Okay.
Or it might have been in Performance Studios. I can't remember. But the set was up in the loft, which was a big white sheet with Ramones printed on it, really primitively. And I said, yeah, these guys are pretty roots, you know. And they played a couple of things, sort of. But the energy was so great. That I thought that it was something that was really worth pursuing, but it needed a lot of work. I also saw them in CBGB's. They didn't have the leather jackets yet. I know that they were like
jackets.
In Beach Boys surfer shirts and stuff, and they'd start a song, never finish it, and get really angry with each other and frustrated, then all of a sudden the bass player Didi would go 1, 2, 3, 4, and they'd start another song. And then it'd be, what song do you want to play? And they'd all start a different song.
But the crowd was still there with it.
Well, the crowd was no one. Yeah. The crowd at CBGB's in those days was the other band that was going to be playing. It was literally...
Do you remember?
I would say there were probably 6 or 7 people in the audience at the first time I ever saw them that might have been punters. And there were other people lined up on the bar, but it was all the people like in... other bands. It wasn't
waiting
even,
for the
it was even
one.
Before Talking Heads were there. Talking Heads played there first, opening up for the Ramones for a show. The first show that I saw Talking Heads and the Ramones together was, there must have been about maybe 15 people in the audience or something like that.
Because, you know, I had David on the podcast with Annie, who does his choreography as well.
Yeah.
Because this podcast is named after This Must Be the Place. It's
called
This Must Be the Gig.
Yeah.
And also David's stories from then, he can't really remember much because it was such a blur.
It's the same with me. I can't give you specific dates, which is why when any of us are talking to journalists over the years, everything's conflicted because you're going, I saw you in 1973. No, I saw you in 1975. You know, nobody really did it. The book that supposedly the Bible that Legs McNeil and the punk guys did is purely apocryphal.
Yeah,
and because it's everybody's own personal recommendations, and they're, hey guys, let's talk about me. And of course, I'm more important than anybody else in this bloody book. You know, so.
You naming places like, you know, these venues were iconic in terms of that
they were
era.
Dumps mostly. Max's was less dumpy.
Yeah,
Max's had an art vibe, and it was. I much prefer hanging out at Max's just because you could actually, you know, feel like you weren't the Bowery where CBGB's was really. Now it's all gentrified, but then it was a place where you could very easily get killed. We'd step over bodies at Blondie's rehearsal loft.
My gosh,
there'd be guys who would die in the. and bums that would die in the hallway, and you'd
wow.
God have to step over them to get to rehearsal. They lived across the street from CBGB.
So when?
Well, they worked there. They didn't live there.
What was the timeline in terms of, so you did you work with the Ramones first and then obviously Talking Heads?
Well, they were about the same time. The Ramones were first.
Were
first. And it took a while to actually get them. I brought them into Richie, my immediate boss, not Seymour. And Richie had this whole idea that he was going to sign all these bands, because I said, look, there's tons of bands here.
Yeah.
There's a blues band called Mink DeVille. There's these guys, there's these guys. And, you know, and I'd go on and on about, and of course, Suicide and all this other stuff. And there's the New York Dolls were still around, but they had lost their record deal. And I said, you know, there's like, if you want to sell a bunch of stuff to Europe, here it is, you know? And even Patti Smith, but that was impossible. She'd already put out her own little record, which eventually did come out on Sire as a reissue. But Robert Mapplethorpe put up some money and they made their own little label with Lenny and her. But in any case, he said, well, you know what we should do? It's like the old days. Because he came from the school of singles.
Yeah.
Everybody had a single. And if you had like four hit singles or three hit singles, you'd get an album.
Gold, yeah.
And what would happen is your three hit singles would be on the album. And then the fastest record they could put together in 6 hours would be the rest of your album. I used to play on records and I'd play on albums that you'd do the... Oh, we're doing an album today. Okay, well, the album would be a rehearsal and an album in 6 hours.
Why did it go so quickly? Was it just
because they didn't want to spend any money on it because it was an ephemeral business?
Yeah.
Nobody knew if any of these bands were going to go anywhere. Mm. But Richie would write hits. Mm. He was part of a songwriting team, and they'd do singles.
Wow.
And when they got a bunch of singles, they'd do an album, or they'd do, this is the important thing, compilations, where they'd take a bunch of different people's singles and put them
out.
And he said, we're going to make an old-time 50s compilation called New York's Finest, which was going to be all of those bands. And he proposed singles deals to every one of them. And they all turned them down, including the Ramones. The Ramones turned down Sire first from the initial time that I brought them in. And then...
How did you get them back?
Well, Tommy was kind of like really down by the fact that they didn't want a singles deal. And Johnny mentioned it in interviews and stuff. You can look at them talking about it, but it's like, well, you don't want a singles deal. I said, well, these people are stupid. You at this point, you can't even make a single. You can only make one big long song, you know? And so then light bulb between Tommy and me. Well, we could make an album for the price of a single if you really worked hard.
Yeah.
And that was the premise that we then went to Richie with.
Yeah.
That if you put up the money, and that's why this notoriously low budget and everything. It's not low budget by today's standards, because today you can make a record on what we're talking into right now for nothing. But then everybody had to go into a studio and you'd have to pay for all this big fancy equipment. So we got
more time was money then.
It was by the hour.
Yeah.
And so we had a very limited budget to make an album. And then the band got slicker and we rehearsed and they went around to a whole bunch of different labels and they got auditioned at different things. I think Blue Rock label, which was Johnny Winter's label. The Steve Paul, who ran some clubs in New York out of that label. It was part of Sony. It was CBS at that point. They became Sony. And they were turned down there. Danny brought them there. Danny had started to manage them. And when Danny started to manage them, Seymour got more seriously into it, the other half of Sire, because Danny was a known like guy with ears and guy on the scene.
They could trust him.
Danny developed a very good working relationship with Seymour's wife at the time, Linda. And the deal sort of became, if she became co-manager of the band, then they were signed.
Wow.
And that's how they got on the label.
So you were the one who really had their back almost from the start. You really did believe
in it. I mean, and they said that. It's in some beautiful thing that they printed for the 43rd anniversary a couple of days ago with the quote from Tommy.
Wow, that's amazing.
That really gives me a lot of homage, which
do you feel
really
like
nice.
You haven't had that over the years? Because I feel like you've done so much and there's been so many names thrown out, you know, over the years, and the things that you've produced and worked on. We mentioned Suicide, Richard Hell. There's been so many things that you've worked on. Do you feel like you've been honored enough over the years, like in terms of how much work you've put in?
I'm more honored that I came and played here at Moogfest on our new album at my age. that's the honor that people are being responsive to my music. Producing is like a craft to me. And I never expected to get any kind of homage for producing, you know. I'd be very hurt if I didn't get a little bit of homage for something I wrote. But for producing, it's like, well, if the band got noticed and what they, my job would be to, as a producer, to get what they wanted to get on out in a format that people could listen to the way they wanted it to happen.
Yeah.
And I could make suggestions. I mean, it was usually, until I get to orchestras later on and back to my day job of quote-unquote classical music, I was far more educated musically than anybody that I was working with in pop, you know. So, and I'd have ideas, and I talked to George Martin about this as well, because he...
Yeah, you did that.
He did the same thing.
Yeah.
He came from a classically trained background, and he would try not to step on toes, the same thing as me. It's like... He didn't go tell the Beatles, "We want to put you should put strings on."
Yeah.
Yesterday, they came to him and said, "You know, it's a story that I don't think he told that often." Mm. They came to him and said, "Paul," it was Paul McCartney came to him and said, "We want to do something special. There's got to be something about this song. It doesn't sound like a real band song." And George said, "Well, what about strings?" And he was like, "Anathema, you know, I don't, because strings on a pop record with these syrupy, crappy things,
course.
You know." And George said, "Well, no, there's other kinds of strings, you know. There's like the stuff like Vivaldi and stuff, and you can do stuff that's really cool." And so, well, let's give it a go. So Paul went around to give it a try, skeptical, and they came up with Yesterday.
Wow.
You know, so that kind of helped.
And look at it's, you know, it's
but
a
but that
song.
Was still a craft. George didn't write Yesterday. That was their song. He brought it.
Elevated.
He helped them bring it to the place where they didn't even know they heard it in their head, but it's kind of what they implied they wanted, and that's what a producer does.
Do you feel more comfortable then? Because obviously you have history with classical music. Do you feel more comfortable in your production role or producing your own material?
Well, I'm much happier producing my own material or something I wrote.
Okay.
Because the thing is, it's rewarding either way.
Mm.
But it's just very simple. In classical, you write it out, and you, in my cases, I conduct it usually. And hey, let's talk about me. I was saying about that before.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's on my shoulders, so you just do what I want.
Yeah.
And there's no discussion. So it's coming out of my head, and I'm trying to pull something out of me, you know. And so I get much more of a sense of satisfaction when that happens. Consequently, and Sheila will tell you, Castle will tell you, who's been sitting quietly while I've been babbling, that she produces me. She co-produces all the things of my own, because what she does is stop me from getting basically disappearing up my own bum in the studio with too many classical ideas.
That's what you need. But it's very hard to discern between what you know is right for your ears and what's right.
Oh no,
for
no, them. She'll tell me that really sucks. and I mean, don't you?
Yes.
Tell me about your first concert experiences. Like, what was the very first concert that you both saw separately?
That we both saw separately?
Yes.
I was told you were going to ask that.
Yes.
And I honestly can't...
It's the premise of the podcast, but not the main thing.
I honestly can't remember. Well, I can remember the very first thing, but it's going to be really not very rock and roll. When I was a kid, my father was fascinated by classical music, which, and my mother played it.
Mm.
And I had a talent for it that they nurtured when I was really young. And
when did you start?
About four.
What did you start playing?
The piano by myself. I'd sit under the piano and hear what my mother was playing, and she was a big fan of opera, and she
and
played opera.
Just played
and so I'd go back after she'd go away to do whatever she would go to do around the house or shopping or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd sit there and dun, 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 dun. I'd pick it out.
Yeah, because your ear was already tuned to that.
Reaching over there and picking around, and she immediately got me lessons and everything. The first gig I ever saw, I was telling it to the optometrist yesterday when he was fixing my glasses, because he's an opera fanatic, was Renata Tibaldi and Richard Tucker and Verdi Mass
Why
Ball.
Why is that not rock and roll? That's rock and roll.
Well, that's it. When I was a kid, I demanded. I have a demand for opera. And the first record I had was Von Karajan conducting Beethoven 6. You know, but then... I don't want to get into that because let's sell our record here, you know? Okay.
Talk to me. So wait, I want to first, before you carry on.
I don't know what your first record...
What was your first show that you saw?
Well, no, Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
How old were you?
No, the thing is we...
Buddy Holly's studio, she was.
What happened is I lived at that point in time with my family in New Mexico, my father and such in that time. And I have an older brother and sister at that point. And so... our family always had been lovers of music, and my brother and I and sister had sung together at home, sit on the porch, do what you need to do. Fortunately, we were in New Mexico, and my older sister said, okay, she was old enough to date and do all that wonderful stuff, and she said...
Bottom line is she was dating somebody in Buddy Holly's band.
So you got tickets?
No, what happened is
she
that...
She went to the studio.
I went to the studio. My sister was, and she didn't... They were going to go somewhere else, shall we say. And she said, we'll just leave it at the studio. Well, there I sat.
Her first concert experience was hearing playbacks in the studio at Norman Petty Sound. Where they were trying to entertain her, so they could go out and make out, you know.
And you sitting in the studio,
watching whatever they were doing.
I didn't know what I was.
That's rock and roll
at the time.
I absorbed it.
You should have adapted the name before the real Peggy Sue Fender. There is a woman named Peggy Sue Fender, actually.
Really?
Yeah, you should have been Peggy Sue Fender.
But so tell me, so now after that, is there before we get into your music that you're doing together?
They can wait over there. All I'm probably going to do is the homage to Henry Cowell and Lou Harrison while they film it. But go ahead, yeah.
So I wanted to ask, was there a show that both of you saw... Maybe not necessarily the first show, but that one where, you know, often you talk to vocalists about finding their voice. Was there a show that made you find your voice in the style of music you wanted to create, in the things you were even doing, you know, back in the day with Blondie, Talking Heads?
The first really rock experience, the first things that, we're talking about sneaking up at windows and listening to Slim Harpo and stuff at juke joints. Mm-hmm. Because I grew up in rural Florida, where on the other side of the tracks, as I became a teenager, is where you'd go to get somebody to buy you alcohol. and then you'd hear the juke joint music playing up there, blues singing. It's the same thing you had it in Texas. Lightning Hopkins is one of the first things you... Mm-hmm. Yeah, but one of the first rock and roll things I heard, and one of the first... experiences was there was a the first one there were many I mean I saw bands that would come through at the Armory shows, and you'd see the Shangri-Las and the Bobby Fuller Four and the Sam the Sham, and everybody who had a hit would tour in these packages. But the thing is that what really impressed me was there was a pop festival, and I was older, I'd already been back and forth to New York once. It was a bunch of bands played on a flatbed truck in a racetrack in Florida, and they had a pop festival.
Okay.
And it was one of the first pop festivals. And the bands that played were The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Blue Cheer, Jimi Hendrix, The Mothers of Invention, and I'm trying to think. There were a couple others, but those were the main ones.
So they all had to go take one by one.
They'd have one stage, which was on the back of a truck, and they'd play. And Blue Cheer impressed me actually the most, although all of those bands were really impressive.
Every name.
Yeah, they were all if you imagine going for an afternoon out and you're going, and those are the bands, that was it. Mm. That was the show. Mm. And it wasn't a huge amount of people or anything. It wasn't like Woodstock. The same people who did that, it was the prototype. The promoters of that did Woodstock. End up doing the Woodstock Festival. Wow. But I'm still in touch with them on Facebook and all of that stuff. But in any case, Blue Cheer was probably the loudest thing I'd ever heard, and it was like a revelation. And I didn't hear it again till the Ramones.
Why was it a revelation?
Well, it was a three-piece that was incredibly loud, and they were so dedicated. Because they were loud, they had very big amplifiers, and the drums weren't very well mic'd, but the drummer was bound and determined that he was going to... be as loud as the rest of the band. Mm. And he was banging the shit out of the drums, you know, and he was flailing away and playing all this intricate kind of stuff that was very, very punk, actually.
Yeah.
And then finally, I was on the side of the stage, and they walked up, the guy walked off stage, threw down his drumsticks, and held his hands in the air, and they were, like, bloody to a pulp. And he was smiling, like, I've done it tonight. And I said... That's rock and roll. So it was like Iggy pre-Iggy.
Yeah. You know,
it was that kind of thing.
But is that the... Do you feel like that's the concert? Like, because you... The stories that I'm sure you have of all the different shows that you've seen, both of you, in your history of being in the industry for so long, is there any moment where, like, something happened at a show and you were like, what is my life? I cannot believe this is happening. Like, that kind of story with the bloody hands...
No, that was important to me. And I said that this is why rock and roll is really cool. But for me, it was the studio always. My first experience is in that. But the thing is that, and that's where I knew I wanted to end up. Because my hands wouldn't get bloody. and also because
you like rock and roll, but not being.
Well, I'd rather manipulate the electronics and actually, it was a combination of what eventually was my love for synths and recording. But I don't think there's a show where it was like the St. Paul moment, you know, Eureka, I found it. That was the closest, was probably that big show where I realized rock and roll was a social force that was more important in my era than the music I was studying every day. Yeah. And that I was going to make that turn to rock and roll. That show was probably it. I wasn't that impressed by the McCoys or something like that. I was very impressed by Blue Cheer and Frank Zappa and Jimi Hendrix especially. I mean, Jimi Hendrix was like another alien.
So how old were you when you
saw that? 18, you know, something like that. Maybe 17. I don't remember what year it was. 67 or 68. But in any case.
But that's where I met him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people we met in different parts of the world.
Well, I know, because you're just saying now you also saw Jimmy when you were that age as well.
Yeah, well, he played Texas on that same tour. He opened for the Monkees. Her band.
You did?
Well, Davy Jones and Mike Nesmith financed them to go out to California. Mike Nesmith was from Texas. Her 67 band.
My 67. Yeah.
What was that called?
There was a band called The Children. It was one of the first psychedelic bands that actually got signed to California. So we took a hearse and crossed the country carrying our equipment.
We were talking about this last night because I was doing this thing with Jimmy Destri. Everybody thinks, so well, you're dropping all these famous names and everything when you're talking about these people, but they're not. Everything was so it was so localized in such a small scene in every town.
So going from that to what are you working on at the moment? For both of you.
We're working on playing the album that we're putting out on the 10th of May that everybody should buy.
What is it called?
I learned that from Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. Buy my album. Yeah.
What is it called, the album?
What, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs? The Woolly Bully.
The album coming out on the 10th.
It's the canon.
Greg, let's start from the beginning.
No, I'm following. The album that's coming out on the 10th.
It's called The Canon.
Okay.
And it's part of the Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music, Volume 2.
Okay.
Which follows up from Volume 1, surprisingly. Yes.
Shocked.
Which came out a few years ago.
Wonderful. And yeah. That's a collaboration between both of you. That's, or did you produce?
That was the first album that Craig and I ever
did. Well, that's Castle producing. Okay. That's mainly, we put albums out under Castle's name when she actually wrote it.
Okay.
And as the driving force, and we put them out under my name, awesome. And when it's me,
but Greg did 4 albums on me,
all
throughout the years. Yeah. But that's because I'm a folk storyteller.
Mm.
We can say it a lot of aspects.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my different movement at that time. But like I said, that's where things started changing.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things for me was to work at Jimi Hendrix Studio, then in New York City.
When was this?
Electric Lady. Yeah.
Yeah. When did you work at Electric Lady Studios?
We did that Sir Douglas Quintet album there. But you've changed the subject.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So the point being.
Oh my God! I love you guys so much. You're it's so great to see this.
Yeah.
I wish people could see it because they just, hopefully they can pick it up by hearing it. But the connection that you have is really wonderful.
It's a strange world.
Yeah. So wait, where did you want to
talk about art?
We produce each other constantly, all the time.
Literally, as we're talking.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. It's just our nature.
It's wonderful.
The first record, let's talk about Nomos.
Yeah.
Well, Nomos is... Well, I don't want to go through the whole story of why it happened. We've said that a whole bunch of times. But how Castle helped immensely in the production of that was that we had no budget whatsoever to do the record. It was like, you know, John's label, John Fahey's label was impoverished, to say the least, you know, and possibly even more impoverished than Revenge International is, but on a good way, because they do art.
Yeah.
They don't have huge budgets for things, but that doesn't mean they can't make brilliant records. Mm. You know, both those labels do. So, and I'm not a guy for huge budgets anyway. But in any case, what were we going to do? It was supposed to be an orchestral record with orchestra and drums and these newfangled synthesizers and all of this stuff. And we had to scrap the orchestra. We had to scrap the drums. We had to scrap all stuff. Yeah. So I said, we have to do it on synths. So we have to go find a studio that we can pay X amount and have an infinite amount of time with these very fiddly instruments.
Yeah.
And she knew a studio from a singer-songwriter that she knew in Texas who'd had a big country hit and couldn't follow it up.
No.
He'd had one of the biggest hit records of all time.
What was the record?
Well, it was a fellow named Willis Allen Ramsey. He wrote a song called he has one of the best debut albums ever.
Whoa.
If you're a record vinyl fanatic and you like 70s singer songwriters, get the Willis Allen Ramsey album.
That is such a great suggestion.
He's amazing. And the song he wrote, which is nothing like the way it came out on the hit, was a song called Muskrat Love for the that the Captain and Tennille covered. And he was all of a sudden rolling in the dough, you know? And it was like, well, I guess I better write another one of these and I better make another album. Well, he's still making that album to this day. But in any case,
he let us use his studio.
We had to rebuild. He'd gotten frustrated because he'd torn his studio apart.
Mm.
And Castle called him knowing he had a small studio. And she said, well, look, we've got like $0, but can we use your studio?
Yeah.
And he was like, I tell you what, I'm going to sell all this crap that I tore apart on the floor. If you guys can solder it all back together again, you can use it, and then as long as I can show it to sell it, you know. And that's what we did. We put his studio back together again, and that's where we made
how
Nomos.
How did you work in the studio on that, on Nomos?
Not well, for an immense amount of time for back then, probably about 10 days.
Yeah.
8 or 10 days.
But,
which
that
is
long, but obviously.
No, in those days, you'd make an album like in 3 days.
Mm.
Oh,
you know.
And once it started, it just sort of came together. And
but again, it was all charted out and everything already. It wasn't like making it up, you know.
Right.
So it just had to be executed. Mm. It wasn't.
It was just another world.
Mm.
It's charted out to the point where I recreated it and 30 years later.
You know, we
have the same we have the same sounds loaded into our computer that we played the other night.
Wow.
Well, we didn't play Nomos the other night. So none of those sounds, I'm sorry, are on the new album. There's very few. Although it's the same synths.
Mm.
We use the same synths on the new album that we did on the old one, plus a couple of new ones.
So are you going to be, in terms of the promotion for the album, are you going to be touring together and playing more?
Well, we have been doing it with Nomos for a long time.
Yeah.
We've played the Canon a couple of times in Europe experimentally.
How's that gone?
It's gone. Everybody loved it. It was amazing. And it was great to see here. People were applauding the songs and they were really, they were really into it. And it was things they'd never heard before. There's been no radio airplay, no internet release other than one kind of teaser track, which is nothing like the rest of the record, but
it's coming on the 10th of May.
10th of May.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to hear it now.
Yeah. And we played the whole thing
the other night
here. Amazing. And we played it in Antwerp and we played it in Barcelona and a couple other places, maybe one or two others. But strangely enough, everybody was really into the concept of it. And they treat it's kind of like a fruition of the Ramones. It's seven pieces, but it's actually one long piece, but we don't yell at each other in between each one. We could, it would be interesting.
You could. Yeah. So do you have a favorite place that you've played then together, a favorite city or a place that you feel like they understand you and understand the work that you've
We like very much where we are here. Moogfest, because it's aficionados and people that are into it. We like playing New York.
Oh, New York's fun.
You know, and we love playing Italy.
Why Italy?
Italy, strangely enough, Italy is the one country where Nomos is almost a pop record.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was one of the most remixed records in the Italian dance scene when it first came out.
And
a couple of guys put it on these huge compilations, and they actually appreciate us very much in Italy, which is strange because I produced a lot of Italian opera singers as well.
But
Ennio Morricone and people like that are Italian mainstays, you know.
Really?
Yeah, but you know, come on, you. What about Ennio?
Oh, Morricone. I mean, we've worked with him. Totally couple of chapters.
That's a whole other.
Keep on going, and how I for the well, not I also love. That part of the music too, but never in my life did I think I would stand with Pavarotti, and he would say, "Vodkesso."
No, don't do an accent. Don't imitate his accent.
But he and I got along like a house.
When did you work with Pavarotti?
1999, 2000, 2001, something like that. We worked on a couple of things with him, but he was very, very sparsely recording in those days. He actually did not like to record towards the end of his life because they kept throwing all these pop records at him.
Yeah,
and
trying to get everything out of them.
And he did all these charity records, which were for a good cause, but he hated the songs usually, and it would be. He'd audition songs while we were working, and it was like, what is this song? Castle, what is this song? And he says, does it really go like this? and I was going, yeah. He said, I would rather sing Brahms than this shit. and the worst thing for an Italian opera singer is to sing something in German.
Yeah.
That's his worst. That song has to be pretty damn bad if he'd rather sing Brahms rather than it.
Working and producing these artists that just have had, you say their name and you are immediately transported into a time, whether you or not you met, they were formative in whatever year when you were younger, and you're saying these Italian composers and Ennio and Pavarotti, do you find that the experience of producing artists like that helped you with your own music?
A lot of the things, like on some of the things that I did with Pavarotti, I actually wrote the arrangements and all of that. So it gave me a real, and I worked on one project that he was on with Ennio Morricone and Louis Bacalov. So for my chops, I learned Italian film music really quickly, which I didn't know. You know, and there's a style to composing Italian film music, which is partially based in Verdi and Puccini opera, but it's not. It actually goes into another kind of formula, which arguably Morricone is one of the inventors of it, and Bacalov as well was. Bacalov's no longer around. But yeah, so you learn from everything. I've learned from the Ramones. I learned from Suicide. We learned from...
What is the cause I feel
nothing
like...
is forbidden, everything's allowed. You know, basically, that's it, you know, just to paraphrase wrongly somebody's uncle, you know. But,
Everyone, open the door. Mm. Don't be afraid to fall down. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And, you know, and just take it in. But, you know, just keep... at it, open up, and if you have to close it, carry it in your heart forever.
I feel like so many creatives in this day and age, because they are watched, you know, social media, you watched and you're under a microscope now, they're so afraid to fail in public because of what happens to their career. But I love that sentiment. Weirdly, both of your sentiments work together in that using that and making a mistake is so beneficial for growth.
But sometimes it isn't a mistake. It's just that you're a million miles ahead of the public.
Learning,
I've had people, like when the band Suicide came out, that very few people were... The people who got it really got it, you know, or the people who really got the Ramones went out and started their own band to be like them, which is what's really important. That's the whole thing about the folk music of rock and roll. And it's the same thing. But it just gets down to the thing is that there's only one bit of advice, and it comes from a country singer, from somebody Castle worked with, Willie Nelson, she was mentioning. And it's, you know... If you're going to make a record, you got to have something to say. It's the other way around. He goes, you can't make a record unless you got something to say, you know, and that's basically it. So if you've got something to say, somebody will listen to it. It may take them 40 years. It may take them, you know, 100 and some years. Nobody knew who Bach was after he died till somebody discovered him in 1830.
Later.
You know, I mean, those who knew about it, most every composer studied him to death. You know, Mozart was studying and Beethoven was studying, but nobody ever played it, you know. And then it took somebody
just
with guts
yourself
to turn around. Mendelssohn goes, you know, I'm going to play this thing. You know, I don't care what anybody says. And people are going to tell me I'm out of my mind and it's stranger than Scott Walker for my era. And he went ahead and did it. And people still didn't get it. But other people then said, hey, it's worth playing, you know.
And going forward, just to wrap up, I feel...
That would have been one of the concerts I would have wanted to see. What about the concerts we didn't see?
I love asking that question.
Yeah, Mendelssohn's Bach would have been one. Beethoven in 1809 or 1808... doing his solo concert at a little theater in Vienna that we visited, where he did Symphony No. 5, Symphony No. 6, right? I mean, he did like his greatest hits all in one night as premieres. The first opening, like we did our album the other night. He did some of the most iconic music in Western history all in one go. And from all the accounts of what happened that night, it sucked. It was under rehearsed.
But God, we would have loved to be there.
But I wouldn't have cared if everything was out of tune and they missed all the cues.
Exactly.
I would have wanted to hear
there.
That. Yeah.
But so the album's out on the 10th.
Yes.
Where can people find you? Like, how do you have a website? Do you have a
Facebook? Well, there's us on. We're on Facebook under my name usually, and we're on. You know, the best thing to do if you want to find out about the record is to go to Revenge International's address.
Okay.
Which hopefully you can tag this with
in an intro
or something.
Definitely.
And you can find our booking agent somewhere in Switzerland in a hidden place, Shakti, and you can call him up if you want us to play.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kivel, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com, Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally, just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.